welcome to another exciting episode of National People Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the dog park of free speech, because you can come here and you can let your free speech off the leash, and it can run and catch frisbees and drool and urinate and all that good stuff, all the good stuff. So go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send the fundage, and wait, there's more. There's an address. Oh, what is that address? It is Double Creek Drive. What is it? There's a 2 and a 2 in Double Creek Drive. I think it's 2251 Double Creek Drive.
That's where
Round
you can...
Texas?
You can
I don't remember the code.
Yeah, mail it to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 7864. You can also...
7864.
You can call in that debit or credit card, 1-800-724-2719, extension 3.
Okay, wow. I'm working on it, but that was progress. That was progress. And I'm in the dog park. So it's good. Dog parks are good. But, I mean, we'd be off-leash anyway. And our show is off-leash. Totally off-leash. So this is part two of the Patrick and Jeremy show. And part one, we had a salute to a great black American, and that is Don Black, whose name is Black, and he's an American. And it was a profile of blackness. And so, salute to Don Black. Go back and listen to the Patrick, In Plain Sight from February 21st, Tuesday, and hear the salute to Don Black. Also, a few shows earlier in the afternoon, the National Bugle Radio with myself and Cato doing a very, I won't call it a deep dive. I will call it a, I don't know, whatever, a very thorough review, of the China-Taiwan business, of Taiwan relationship. It's situation as part of China.
If you don't deep dive, are you snorkeling? Was it a snorkel?
Oh, I do snorkel. I have gone scuba diving once in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, and I did okay. And I'm down there, and there's this giant fish. It was like it looked like J. Edgar Hoover. So imagine a giant J. Edgar Hoover head that's got fins coming out where the ears should be and no body, but it's enormous. And I saw that, you know, and then I thought, you know, I'm 30 feet below the surface, surrounded by water, and I'm an air-breathing mammal. And then I thought, no, I'm putting that thought out of my brain. I put it right out of my brain. And I did okay. I never scuba dived again. Have you ever gone scuba diving?
I've not. I just dove off of the diving board into the deep end of the pond.
Well, you know, I like snorkeling better. And you don't have to go deep. You just can be at the surface looking down. And I've done that. And coral, I've done it in kelp. Actually, kelp is a pretty good place to do snorkeling. You can snorkel and see little octopus and fish and other stuff. And it's more relaxed. So
we weren't exactly deep dive. Well, no, we did a pretty good deep dive, yeah, actually, on last night's show, but we were right in the middle of talking about China and Taiwan. I think I compared it to the Ukraine. Taiwan is, how do we put it? The U.S. is using Taiwan as a leverage against China, just like they think that Ukraine is a leverage against Russia.
Yeah. You know what would be a good word? Pawn. I mean, it's a sacrificial pawn. So Ukraine is being used as a sacrificial pawn in this Jewish scheme against Russia, where they have this scheme where they think they're going to overthrow Vladimir Putin. It's not going to happen. And they've sacrificed Ukraine, and they're not getting anything for it. They're just, the fact it's going to be checkmate. I think it's going to be checkmate before long. And, Taiwan would be a pawn that they would use against China, and it's not going to work.
Yeah, so we were talking about the computer chips produced in Taiwan, and how, you know, Taiwan is very beneficial to China. And if the, you know, Jewish dominated States Department thought maybe their kind of thinking is, you know, have a war in Taiwan, destroy everything there, and thus hurt China. Probably is the thing.
Well, you know, they had a war in Ukraine and wound up destroying the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And I guess that was payback for Adolf Hitler because it destroys Germany's industry.
I can see that.
It's all destructive. The thing is, with the Ukraine, this scheme to overthrow Vladimir Putin by getting him to attack Ukraine, and then use that attack as the pretext for crippling economic sanctions, it might have worked in 2017 or 2016. It might have worked in 2017 if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, because Victoria Nuland was rumored to be her choice for Secretary of State. And this is Victoria Nuland's thing. But what's happened is over the years since 2013, 2014, because economic sanctions were being slapped on Russia even before then, but they were certainly being slapped on Russia in after 2014, after the coup, because Russia did annex Crimea, and Vladimir Putin, who is a very cautious and conservative economic manager, he said, okay, we're not going to be over-reliant on energy exports. We're going to just start investing in our own manufacture. And he embarked on a policy of what is called import substitution. So they used to get a lot of food, a lot of consumer products from overseas, and they would pay for those consumer products with their oil revenue. They'd use their oil revenue to buy consumer products and other things. And he said, okay, we're just going to build up our own industry. So we're making our own blue jeans, and we're making our own toothpaste, and we're making our own cheese, and we're just going to build up this stuff. And if we have to pay a little extra for it, we'll pay a little extra for it, but it'll be domestic. And then we don't have to use our oil reserves or our oil revenues to buy these things. And so it made the economy much more resilient and much less vulnerable to the to sanctions. And this is something that Stephen F. Cohen was talking about 6, 7, 8 years ago. He was talking about this. And so the sanctions did not work against Russia, partly because of this economic policy, partly because Russia's diplomacy, with Sergei Lavrov is really the world's foremost diplomat. Russia's diplomacy, they kept not just China friendly and, you know, kept China from participating in the sanctions, but India. And I know you had an article about Russian-Indian relations.
Yeah, we'll get right to that. So, I mean, you're describing Russia as becoming very isolationist since 2014 coup, almost as if Putin anticipated some sort of conflict in the Ukraine.
Not isolationist. The word's protectionist in terms of its economic policy. Yeah,
protectionist. That's isolationist. Cool.
Economic. Well, yeah, it's kind of the economic version of isolationism, and isolationism is more like foreign policy. But Russia's okay. Not isolationist foreign policy, but it became much more self-sufficient economically.
Well, as you mentioned, different countries are picking sides in this. This is why I think we've been in World War III for a year. Most of it economic. And as you mentioned, India. So this is from WKMS. It's a channel that I pull up every morning. I listen to classical music on it. It's a local channel out of Paducah and Murray State. Liberal. They do a lot of NPR stuff. They got a good article here. A year into the Ukraine war, the world's biggest democracy still will not condemn Russia. So when I hear the world's biggest democracy, I tend to think of Israel, but that's not it. That's Israel is the world's only democracy in the Middle East.
Yeah.
This is the world's biggest democracy, so India. And there's a picture here of Russian President Putin meeting with India's Prime Minister Modi. And this is from Mumbai. In the years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Western democracies have condemned Moscow and slapped wide-ranging sanctions on it, cut back on Russian oil and gas, and sent unprecedented amounts of arms and ammunition to help Ukraine. But the world's biggest democracy, India, hasn't done any of that. So is India's part of BRICS, aren't they? Yeah, that's the I in BRICS.
Yeah, that's the I in BRICS.
So this is almost like an answer to NATO, right? This is like a response to NATO. These countries coming together against the West.
Well, I mean, BRICS is an economic alliance. NATO is a military alliance. I would say it's what, I mean, like the EU is, EU started off as an economic alliance. Now it's, you know, it's almost like become a political entity, almost like a super state. BRICS, it fills, I guess it's starting to fill some of the roles that were played by things like the the World Trade Organization, the IMF. It's an economic alliance, and the member countries are creating these new alternatives to things like the IMF, the World Bank, and the SWIFT system and other economic institutions.
Yeah, so, you know, the article goes on to say that Europe is backing away from buying Russian oil and gas. India has doubled down on buying Russian oil at bargain prices. So India's buying the dip, all right? And so not only that, but India is placing orders for Russia-made weapons. So India is seeing an economic opportunity here with the fall of the West economically.
Yeah. So India and Russia do, and the article talks about this, India and Russia actually have a very, very long history. So ever since India has become an independent country, which was, 1947, I think, is when it got its independence from Britain, it has been it was close to the Soviet Union. And that might seem weird because the Soviet Union was all communist and everything, a communist dictatorship, and India had its elections. So it was the world's biggest democracy. And yet, in terms of the Cold War, it sided with, to an extent, I mean, it was really a non-aligned country, so it wasn't really siding with either side, but it bought its weapons from the Soviet Union. And it had, good relations.
That makes sense because the British Empire was dominant until World War II. I mean, you could say that World War II was basically the end of the British Empire and the beginning of the American Empire. And so India was always under control of the British Empire. So when it got out from under that, it went to Russia. Is that too simplistic?
There's some of that because during the first half of the 20th century, where you had most of the world was under the control of some European country, or whether it was England or France or Holland or Belgium or Portugal or Spain, there were these colonial movements, and the Soviet Union was trying to exploit these colonial movements. And so a lot of anti-colonialists had good feelings towards the Soviet Union. So that's part of it. The other thing is that British India included not just what we call India today, but also Pakistan and Bangladesh. They were part of British India. And when India got its independence, you had this a split of the country. The country was divided with a majority Hindu states and provinces becoming what we know as India, and the majority Muslim states and provinces becoming Pakistan, East and West Pakistan, and eventually East Pakistan became Bangladesh. But you had this division along religious lines, and as Hindus left the areas that became Pakistan, and Muslims in fairly large numbers left the areas that became India, you had a lot of violence, an awful lot of violence. And I think like 3 million people died. Now, in an area with many hundreds of millions of people, 3 million people didn't necessarily seem like such a big deal. I think 3 million is how many died. And so India was really, it became independent. It was born into a rivalry with Pakistan. So you had that rivalry. You also had, because British India or India and China have a long border in the Himalayan mountains where hardly anybody lives. So you've got this very long border in a kind of no man's land. Well, where exactly is that border demarked? Which virtually uninhabited mountains are part of India and which are part of China? And they might be virtually uninhabited, but they might also be militarily valuable. And so India and China fought a war. So India came into its existence with two big enemies, one being Pakistan and the other being China. So the Cold War, the main feature of the Cold War was a rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. And most of the world wound up taking one side or another. And China, even though it was communist, there was a giant rivalry between Mao and Khrushchev. And there was a split between China and the Soviet Union. And so China, even though it was communist, was effectively allied with the United States. Well, your enemy's enemy is your friend, right? And your enemy's friend is your enemy. So China was effectively allied with the United States. Pakistan was openly and formally allied with the United States. So with its big two enemies being allied with the United States, it was natural for India to ally itself with the Soviet Union. And so it bought a whole bunch of military hardware from the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, Pakistan was buying a whole bunch of hardware from the United States. Does that make sense?
This is something I heard about as a child. India and Pakistan having nukes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, United States arming Pakistan, Russia arming India. Did I get that right?
Yeah,
I always said that. That's why these two third world countries became nuclear power, was because of the scenario that you just laid out.
Yeah. So India, and both of these countries got their weapons outside of the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So they're outside that framework. And so India, it detonated its bomb in 1976 or so, sometime in the mid-70s. And Pakistan, maybe the early 1990s, they detonated theirs. India's got much, you know, they've got a space program, so they've got rockets, better missiles, and they've got a bigger arsenal. But Pakistan's got its own arsenal. And you know, the two countries could fight a war with each other. But here's what's really significant about what's going on now. So India was China's enemy, and the Soviet Union was China's enemy. I mean, the Soviet Union and China a couple of times came on the verge of war. I think once during the Nixon administration, once during the Carter administration, they were on the verge of a war, an open, hot war. Their relations were horrible. Right now, China is effectively allied with Russia. Well, guess what? Also, even though China and India are still rivals, they're both in BRICS, and they're both supporting Russia. And so they're closer together. This is a major realignment of world politics.
Where does Pakistan fall in this? I haven't heard a lot on them.
So Pakistan's weird. When the Ukraine war first started, the prime minister of Pakistan was supportive of Russia. His name, Imran Khan. He is a cricket player, a legendary cricket player, and basically a based guy, but not a particularly good government administrator. I guess he's kind of like a Donald Trump type. So he was a popular figure. He was a celebrity. He became leader of the country, didn't do a particularly good job of it. And then he got basically cheated out of office last spring. And once he got cheated out of office, then the public started saying, well, okay, he might not have been a very good prime minister, but this was basically a coup d'etat. It's illegitimate. So Pakistan was supporting Russia in this conflict. Right now, its situation, I'm not exactly sure.
Do you truly want to stay out of the system? Are you prepared to buy into the biggest scam since the Iraqi dinar? If not, then put your money where it belongs, in your possession, not in the hands of an international MLM cartel. At Kettle Moraine Limited, we will provide you with the finest Swiss-minted detachable gram sheets of pure 24-karat gold for hundreds of dollars less than the so-called privately issued credit cards with elusive gold backing. Gold backing? The only gold that I want is in my back pocket, not backed by promises of an operation even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suspect of, giving a rating of C-. To get the full story, visit Sierra Madre Precious Metals.com and go to the Valcombe Bullion Vault. Once you have read the whole story about the scam being perpetrated on an unsuspecting public and how you can avoid being a victim by purchasing these beautiful, barterable, tradable sheets of gold at tremendous savings and in the strictest of privacy, be prepared to take the steps to protect your wealth with the purchase of the real deal. Detachable 50-gram gold bars from Kettle Moraine Limited by calling 602-799-8214. Ask about our 1-ounce Valcombe detachable bars, which break into 1/10-ounce bars. And don't forget, for all of your precious metal needs, whether buying or having the need to sell, call Kettle Moraine Limited. Remember, no dinar, no celery, and no carrots. If you buy from someone else, tell them you want AU, not BS. Call Kettle Moraine LTD today at 602-799-8214. Kettle Moraine LTD, 602-799-8214.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email proudsouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
Illegitimate. So Pakistan was supporting Russia in this conflict. Right now, its situation, I'm not exactly sure, and everything's kind of fluid. And, you know, they will have elections sooner or later, and Imran Khan may return. But I can't say a whole lot more on Pakistan.
Well, what you have said, and what is evident, countries that were once sort of hostile to each other, Russia, India and China, are now all allied, at least economically.
Yeah,
they're coming together
against, or at least outside of Zionist American power. And you know, Pakistan, like people might think, oh, these are little, you know, tin pot countries. Pakistan's got 250 million people.
Well,
Pakistan's got like 2/3 of the population, more than 2/3 of the population that the United States has.
And the article,
they're relatively poor, but still.
The article brings up that India is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. They're saying that by 2030, India is going to be the third largest economy in the world under the U.S. and China. Well, I mean,
yeah,
all the Indians own our gas stations, liquor stores, and hotels.
No, they do. They do. Some of them might be Pakistanis, but yeah.
Well,
and
I mean,
Pakistan, the mayor of London is Pakistani. So you got, there are a lot of Pakistanis in Britain, but you got some here too.
Most of the liquor store and gas station owners have the dot on their forehead, you know, the third eye.
Hindu. That would be Indian, not Pakistani.
Right. That's the third eye of Hinduism. Yeah. I remember the 90s band Third Eye Blind. That might be outside of your culture.
It is. Yeah.
All the Gen Xers know what I'm talking about. Third Eye Blind. Anyway, they have that dot on their head, and that's how you can tell. No, seriously, every liquor store, every gas station, literally, there's only one gas station that's not owned by Indians in my small town. I do business with it all the time. But like, you get into especially bigger cities in Kentucky, Illinois, Missouri, Missouri, Arkansas, and Tennessee, and you're going to find Indians. You know, with the little dot heads.
Right. And then, you know, when I was on my white boy summer road trip, I stay in dives. Of course I do. And every dive is run by Mr. Patel. These are Patels. There is a cast of, an ancient cast of motel operators.
You said cast. Go ahead.
They're a cast. And they all have the same last name, and it's Patel.
No, I know somebody named Patel here in Mayfield. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, this is a little side. Let's chase a rabbit real quick, a little rabbit hole. So what was it in the 90s, I think it was under Clinton, that basically allowed Indians to come over here and buy up all this stuff at, like, very low tax, almost tax-free, and they pretty much put the white, like, middle class out of business? Because in the 90s, I remember a lot of white people owned the gas stations and the liquor stores and the hotels. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, since the early aughts, that's not a thing anymore. It's all Indians or possibly Pakistanis. Do you remember that? What was that? Did Clinton initiate that? It was something where they come in and immigrate over here and buy up these places at really low or no taxes.
Honestly, I think there was a fascination deep dive on this at some point. But what I recall, I mean, you have these various visa programs. And I think one of the visa programs, it makes it easy to immigrate over here if you're going to invest a certain amount of money and create a few jobs, right? Well, the thing is, investing money, that means you're buying something. So if you're buying a motel, you're investing money. And then if you've got your wife and your kids and maybe your cousin or something working for you, you're creating jobs. And I don't know all the details, but there's visa programs and there's a visa category. I don't know. We always hear about H-1-2 visas, and maybe this is like H-1-4 or something else. But then also, I believe there's some sort of lending program where these people who are going to create jobs and invest money, they also have access to fundage.
Well, it was
I can't tell you the details.
It displaced like white business owners in America hugely, bigly.
Yeah, well, there's something that was going on in the 80s. There was this big trend in the 80s where whites who were good at school, they went into finance. They started going, not even finance so much, but MBAs. They started getting MBAs. They went to business school, and they were getting MBAs. It was a big push for that. And, you know, so they were getting into, consulting. They're getting into finance. Nobody was doing small business. Nobody was doing Main Street. And so, Main Street died, and you had strip malls, and the strip malls, I remember strip malls are good. I had a friend who had an ice cream store in a large strip mall. It was the only American-run store. Everything else in the strip mall was run by one kind of foreigner or another. And so, whites kind of deserted.
The truth. You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
Einstein once said, "Future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies." What did he know? Imagine you hear ocean waves caressing a beach, or a favorite song from the past, or the trickle of the babbling brook. All of these are sound frequencies that positively affect us. Terahertz is a soothing, healing frequency that has been proven to resonate at the same frequency as healthy cells. It penetrates the body and stimulates new healthy cell growth. Want to diminish muscle aches, joint pains, and experience a greater sense of well-being? Tired of spending money on short-term remedies that never seem to work? Soothing, healing, relaxing terahertz frequency is now available and as handy as flipping a switch. Terahertz technology is changing the course of what we were taught about how to maintain our health and well-being. To read more about this amazing breakthrough and to order your terahertz frequency wand, go to naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen planned to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful, loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile OxySilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
February is Heart Month. Every year for the month of February, to show our appreciation to Extendivite's faithful customers, we have a sale. If you would like to try Extendivite, now is the time to get a few months ahead and really give Extendivite the time to show you how it works. Most of Extendivite's long-term customers wait for this sale to stock up. People and doctors tell us about the unbelievable improvements that they have experienced in their overall health, not just the heart. Extendivite wants you to experience the power of these herbs. Get a four-month supply for only $115 for either the capsules or tincture. Please take advantage of this once-per-year sale and get healthy for life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or find us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
In a large strip mall, it was the only American-run store. Everything else in the strip mall was run by one kind of foreigner or another. And so, whites kind of deserted. Maybe not in Kentucky, but in the suburbs, whites just deserted small business. And to the extent that they got into, went to college and studied stuff. They weren't even going into engineering anymore. They weren't going into engineering. They weren't going into science. They were just going into business management for large companies, like getting MBAs, or they were getting into finance. That was the 1980s, and they were yuppies. These were the yuppies. I'm sure you've heard that term.
Young urban professional.
Yep. So, and it created a giant vacuum in Main Street and in small business that got filled up by a lot of immigrants like the Patels. But it also created a big vacuum in sciences and the engineering profession. And those also got sucked in Chinese and Indian engineers. And that's the H-1B visa. The H-1B visa, that is, in particular, Indians taking advantage of that.
So that explains it, yeah. So getting on to this WKMS article, India buys more oil from the Middle East countries than Russia does. But its Russian share has skyrocketed. So in December of this past year, India imported 1.2 million barrels of Russian crude, 33% more than a year earlier. So you do have this economic alliance taking place in the wake of the Ukraine war. Getting back to the original point, India, Russia, and China are economically allied. And, you know, you're saying that Putin foresaw this or maybe had a contingency plan for this before he, you know, went into Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, Putin is, you can go back, he made a very big speech, which you sent an article about that speech. But he made, you know, he's made a lot of significant speeches in his career. And you could go back to a speech he made, I think, at the Munich Security Conference in 2007. And he was warning about, I guess, the arrogance of the so-called West and the, you know, the assumption that they're going to continue to, there's going to continue to be some sort of unipolar world. He's been warning about this stuff for decades now. And he has made contingencies and he's built up his alliance, his economy, and he has been engaged in diplomacy and built up these alliances with countries that are important. And, you know, you could think of India as being just a third world country, but India has more engineers than any other country. And India, by the end of this decade, it's supposedly going to pass up Japan as the world's third largest economy. And, you know, you think of BRICS and you think China, the world's largest economy, and then India, soon to be the third largest, and then Russia, which has massive resources and military, and then Brazil also has massive resources. These are big countries and big economies. And now you've got other countries that are clamoring to either join BRICS formally or at least ally themselves. And so you've got Turkey and Indonesia and potentially even Saudi Arabia. That is a real big economic bloc that we're talking about. And even if they're kind of poor because they've got a lot of people, but in terms of overall economic production and resources and output, this is enormous. And it really does, it spells the end of domination by America. And when we say America, we mean an America that is basically a zombie host for a Jewish virus.
Yeah, with Saudi Arabia, you know, I guess in the 70s, America based their dollar, the petrodollar, the infamous petrodollar, for countries to buy oil, Saudi Arabia in U.S. dollars. Now that's not the case. They're selling it to in rubles and yuan, right? But that alliance is breaking down. The West and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, I've long said that the importance of the petrodollar in, you know, our era is exaggerated. In the 1970s, two things. One is that that foreign trade in products was made up a much bigger part of foreign exchange than it does now. Because what happened is you started getting much more finance based foreign exchange, you know, trading dollars for foreign currencies, and you started getting a lot more speculation, way more speculation. And so the amount of foreign exchange that is backed by actual trade and products is really minuscule now. And then also the amount of oil, the percentage of foreign trade that is oil, is much smaller. There's a lot of stuff that's traded now. So I really don't, I think the petrodollar is already dead. But it's, you know, it's still significant. If Saudi Arabia aligns itself with BRICS or joins BRICS as a member, and psychologically, if Saudi Arabia stops insisting that the oil it sells is denominated in dollars, psychologically that's it means something. It's not as important as most people think, though.
But I mean, with Saudi, you know, huge ally. You know, Saudi Arabia is a huge ally with Israel, which is really ironic. Saudi Arabia being Sunni dominated, the most radical branch of Islam, united with Jews. That's interesting. I'm not even going to get into the Sabbatean stuff, but that's huge. And so, I mean, maybe Israel is sticking its finger up in the air and seeing which way the wind's blowing on this, because they're not really, you know, the diaspora Jews definitely. In the West, are hell bent on the destruction of Russia and China, but the Israeli Jews seem to be like waiting to see how this thing plays out. And this is something we discussed before, but it's worth discussing again.
Yeah, that's my opinion. And I know, like, so it's not as if I think that diaspora Jews and Israeli Jews are two different rival factions against each other. I think that they have largely the same goals, but not necessarily the same priorities. So maybe they all see Iran and China and Russia as enemies. But if you have to draw up a list of who to deal with first, the Israelis would want to deal with Iran first, and the diaspora Jews want to deal with Russia first. But right. Then I would also say that the people in the military who have adopted Jewish enemies, they've adopted the Jewish enemies list, they look at it and they say, well, no, China's the biggest. We got to take on China first. I don't think that's so much Jews. I think the Jews in America, see China as a potential, dominant world power. And if China's going to be the dominant world power, then how do Jews dominate the world? Because they can't dominate China. Jews can dominate the world through Russia, through the United States, through, to a lesser extent, the EU. Once upon a time, they could do it through Russia, but they can't now. But yeah, I think that the priorities of Israelis and diaspora Jews are different, even if their ultimate goals are not that different.
Well, yeah, if the Jews can't dominate China, they have to cooperate with it. That's going to be the ultimate.
Yeah.
Sort of business deal. This two-pronged power, and I'll bring it up in Jewish power as well as Gentile empires. This two-pronged power goes back, if you will allow me to get religious just for a moment, in the Pharisees and the Sadducees, groups of Jewish elites 2,000 years ago that had differing religious opinions, but they both came together in opposition to Jesus Christ, who they saw as a threat to them. And so I think you see that today, two-pronged Jewish powers who seem to be against each other on certain issues, but they ultimately have the same goals, when it comes to their enemy.
So this isn't a religious show, but it's not an anti-religious show either. So you said the Pharisees, and what was the other group?
Sadducees. I mean, religiously, the Sadducees.
Explain them to me. Most of our listeners probably know what you're talking about. Explain them to me.
Well, both acknowledged the law of Moses, but Sadducees did not acknowledge like the resurrection, and that's something that the Pharisees did acknowledge. So religiously, they opposed each other, but at the end of the day, they both came together against Jesus Christ, who opposed all of them and had him put to death.
But you're saying the Pharisees believed in the resurrection? The resurrection of what?
Of the body.
The body?
Yes. Of the body of people that believed in God.
Okay.
And the Sadducees did not acknowledge the resurrection. That was just one of many like religious disputes that they had. The point being that even though they seemed to oppose each other, they came together real quick when Jesus called them out on their nonsense and on their oppression of the people. And they opposed Jesus Christ and his ministry. And I'm bringing this to relevancy today. You may have Israeli Jews and diaspora Jews, and amongst the diaspora, you may have like Stephen Steinlein Jews that want to oppose immigration because they see opposing immigration as better for the Jews in the long run, whereas mm-hmm. the all Jews want to just flood this country and get rid of the whites immediately. You know, they both seem to have opposing views, but they come together on at the end of the day on eliminating white people.
Uh-huh.
That's sort of the relevance that I wanted to bring that point to.
Okay.
And then,
yeah.
Well, let me go even further. I mean, there's a two-pronged power in Gentile world empires. And let's take this all the way back to Rome, a Gentile empire. It got so big that it split in two, Rome and Constantinople. And so you had this two-pronged division, this imperial division on the globe at the time. And then eventually you had the Holy Roman Empire, and then the Muslims took Turkey, and you had the Ottoman Empire, right? And that was dissolved in World War I, Germany taking the side of the Ottomans, and the British Empire basically taking, the German Second Reich down. Hitler brought up the Third Reich, and World War II saw the the decline of the British Empire, and that power transferred to the American Empire in the West and the Russian communism in the East. And so you've always had this two division of global power. And now that's being even more accentuated, you know, as we're talking about, you know, the West and NATO, even if economically, just opposed to Russia, Iran, Syria, India, and China. All right, so you have this two-pronged power where one's not able to conquer the other. But that could be changing in real time, you know, as Russia and China, with all their alliances, as we discussed, and the world is not any more unipolar. I mean, it was unipolar maybe for a decade or two with the United States after the disintegration of the Soviet Union, but the U.S. is no longer a unipower. It's back to a two-pronged, you know, position of power, East and West. Did any of that make sense? Did I articulate that correctly?
I think so. And I've got a couple questions.
Sure.
So you mentioned the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and they came together to oppose Jesus, but there were also Jews who followed Jesus, Jews and non-Jews, right? Jews and Greeks who followed Jesus. And, you know, those Jews who followed Jesus became Christians. They had children. They have descendants. Who are their descendants? I mean, I think one group I would say is almost certainly their descendants. Are you familiar with the Assyrians who live in Syria and they speak Aramaic?
Yeah, they're descendant from the Assyrian Empire, and more particularly in northern Israel, the Sumerians, who are a mixture of Assyrians and Jews. They were looked down upon by Jews. But yeah,
so Assyrians of today, I mean, it's my understanding that they're at least partly descended from the Hebrews of the Bible, who wound up following Jesus, because they practice Christianity. They're Christian. They speak Aramaic.
Yes, there was a racial mixture. You know, Jews, Greeks.
I had a student in one of my classes once. She was pretty, and I swore she was Jewish. Well, I found out no, she's not Jewish. She is Assyrian, and her native language was Aramaic. So there are, and, you know, maybe some of the Lebanese, maybe some of the other groups, especially Christian groups, like, you know, a lot of Lebanese are Christians. A lot of them may well be descendants of Jews from the Bible who followed Jesus. Does that sound plausible?
Well, yeah.
Those Jews who followed Jesus, they continued to have babies, and so they have descendants, right?
They were assimilated, and you can find them in the seven churches of Revelation, which were in Asia Minor, you know, modern-day Turkey. But, like, the hardcore Jews that practiced, you know, the Judaism that opposed Christ, a lot of them were dispersed in 70 AD, you know, all throughout Europe.
By Titus.
Right. Titus and Vespasian, who sacked Jerusalem because there was a Jewish revolution against the Roman Empire in 66 AD. And by 70 AD, they had surrounded Jerusalem and destroyed it. They destroyed the temple. And that's where you get the diaspora, right, throughout Europe. And then some Jews blended with Germanic peoples. Those would be the Ashkenazi Jews.
And retained a Jewish identity.
Yes, they did retain a Jewish identity, but they were mixed in with Germanic peoples. This would be what they would call the Ashkenazi Jews, because Ashkenaz in Hebrew in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10 are German Ashkenaz. But
and
yeah,
so,
you're right.
Okay, so you have descendants of, let's say you have descendants of the Jews or the Hebrews in the Bible, some of whom mixed with, you know, Germanic people and became Ashkenazi, some of whom mixed maybe with Spanish people and became Sephardic Jews, and then some of whom mixed with maybe other Middle Eastern groups and became Assyrian Christians or Lebanese Christians, Mennonites. And so here's the question. Some of them retained a Jewish identity. Others lost a Jewish identity. Who's better off?
I mean, the ones that joined Christianity are better off. But, I mean, you had the Talmud in circa 500 AD, And so any of these Jews that mixed, or any of them that didn't mix, that chose to follow Talmudic Judaism, those were the ones that sort of separated themselves from the Christian Europeans and went into the ghettos, right? So the Talmudic Jews, and they're a mixture. I mean, Ashkenazi, Sephardic, whatever. They sort of clung to this particular religion. And Talmudic Judaism is a perversion of the Christian Old Testament.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Tune in Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 Central, to the Alternative Media with your host, Farron. If you've not been listening, this is some of what you've been missing.
2,000 mules, like you like to say occasionally, Farron, in your face.
They might have a set of lactating mammaries available that could provide milk for their adopted children.
Listen, news media, all pulling off this gigantic fraud.
Rhino, neocon, cucks.
There's this wonderful thing that's called Vote With Your Feet. Move to California.
I am a conspiracy factualist, and everyone else is a reality theorist.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of ships came out of nowhere.
Give me liberty, or let's give you death.
Any excuse to go and kill yourself for this fraud of a government. This goes back 100 years.
When they come for your gold, give them a lead. And when they come for your guns, give them the bullets first. And God help us all.
In times like these, you can't depend on the government to keep you warm and fed. But you can depend on the Vermont Bun Baker to do just that. With the Vermont Bun Baker, you'll never be in a situation where you can't cook, bake, fry, boil water, or heat your home all at the same time. One of the most revolutionary cook stoves, wood stoves ever, the Vermont Bun Baker is available with or without soapstone veneer, a natural stone that retains heat and radiates it back into the room once the fire is out. A beautiful addition to your home. The Vermont Bun Baker has an efficiency rating well above 75% and qualifies for the wood stove tax credit. For more information, watch the Vermont Bun Baker on YouTube and live stream, or visit us at www.vermontwoodstove.com. You can also reach us by calling 1-866-SOAPSTONE. Don't ever be hungry or cold because the power's gone out. With a Vermont Bun Baker, all you have to worry about is what's for dinner.
So the Talmudic Jews, and they're a mixture. I mean, Ashkenazi, Sephardic, whatever. They sort of clung to this particular religion. And Talmudic Judaism is a perversion of the Christian Old Testament. And so these are the people that you have. And that's why you have a lot of Jews that look European. You know, the Ashkenazi have a lot of European features and were able to blend in with the European populations.
Yeah.
And the only way to help. Yeah. The only way to tell them apart was if you pulled their pants down. I mean, that's pretty crude.
But this is the thing. Now, you can't even do that because they stole our foreskins.
Since the late 1800s, the middle 1800s in Britain and the late 1800s in America, they pushed circumcision as healthy and, you know, to try to avoid sexually transmitted diseases before, what's the thing you treat STDs with? Penicillin, amoxicillin, before that invention. So they pushed it as a medical thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I covered this with William last week. 80% of Americans are circumcised, American males.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the thing, like when Andrew Yang ran for president, I wasn't into that whole bag thing. I wasn't into the whole, the free check. What did he call it? The guaranteed income. I wasn't into that, but he did say in one interview, he said he would favor, outlawing circumcision. And in fact, I think he said something about, some weird Chinese trick that would get our foreskins back. And for that reason, and that reason alone, I was interested in Andrew, Yang, but I don't know whatever happened with that. Anyway, we're almost out of time. Did we keep it classy?
We tried. It's very difficult, but the only thing we didn't cover was Putin's speech. Is there anything significant in Putin's speech that you want to mention?
Putin's speech, they're always significant. He's withdrawing, or at least temporarily freezing, Russia's participation in a strategic arms reduction treaty. But I mean, the main thing is that he was saying, you know, there's no way that the West is beating Russia on the battlefield in Ukraine. And of course they're not. This is what I've been saying. There is no way that Russia is not going to meet its military objectives. What are those military objectives? Well, those military objectives are changing, and they're becoming more and more grandiose as days go by, because Ukraine and its Western backers are losing more and more and more, and also creating more necessity. I mean, there's been more and more oppression of ethnic Russians in Ukraine, and so there's less willingness on behalf of the Russian government to leave ethnic Russians in Odessa or Mykolaiv or these other places, to leave them inside a rump Ukraine where they're going to be abused. So it's very significant. And Russia's going to meet its military objectives, and America is losing. And that's a good thing, because the American government is not our friend.
And we still have this two-pronged power of East and West, but that's rapidly collapsing. It looks like the East is going to take it.
Yeah, and it's a good thing, and people have to wake up and embrace reality. And smell coffee, too. Smell coffee.
I like coffee.
Yeah, why not? Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me, Jeremy.
Thank you, Patrick. Stay classy, my friend.
And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode, an informative Putin episode of National People Radio.
One of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs. For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.